I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
If you're working as an accountant and you lose your job, nobody really notices.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Moe!
Rugby weekly.
Little reverse pass.
Drive for Ireland!
Magic!
Hello, the 42 members, and welcome to Rugby Weekly Extra. Murray Kinsella is taking some well-earned time off, so it's Gavin Casey here, sitting in to chat about Super Rugby, and I'm joined on the line, as Murray was last week, by our good friend Owen Toolan. Owen, you're still locked down in Victoria. You were just telling me that it will remain the case for a few weeks yet. What's the last week or so been like back at stage three, as it is over there?
Yeah, hey Gav, how are you? It's been frustrating. Kind of, we thought we were a bit in the all clear from kind of the stringent lockdown laws that have been in place, and to go back into them is very frustrating, especially as the rest of Australia and indeed you guys over that side of the world seem to be getting back to some form of normality. But yeah, we've essentially been given a 6-week window now at stage three levels, which essentially is you're only able to leave your house for either work, food, exercise, or if you're a caregiver. So quite a big police presence around Melbourne at the moment. And I think even yesterday there was about $250,000 worth of fines handed out to people breaking those kind of parameters. So we're back to baking and drinking quite a large volume of wine at the moment, so not much else we can do.
Well, listen, at least there's rugby to watch this Absolutely. Time around, and I'm sure you would have been glued to it regardless, pandemic or no pandemic, with particularly that fixture in Christchurch over the weekend. It was probably the most tantalizing prospect and one that people would have earmarked as being maybe the standout fixture in both New Zealand and Australia, really, in these versions of Super Rugby as they've begun to play out now. I think it lived up to its billing. You're going to talk us through it a lot more forensically than I am, obviously. But ultimately, it had been 16 years since the Blues had beaten the Crusaders away from home. It's been 3 years since anybody has won in Christchurch at all. And Saturday kind of proved why that's the case, I think, in the end, didn't it?
It did. Blues have definitely, in the first few rounds of the competition, kind of stamped their authority and demonstrated that after a kind of a long few years in the wilderness, kind of come back into kind of provincial rugby New Zealand and are playing exceptionally well. And yeah, I'm not sure. It could be even a bit longer since I think the Crusaders were beaten in Canterbury. I know when we were at the Melbourne Rebels back in 2015, I think might have been their last defeat in Christchurch, which is just incredible when you think the amount of games have played between then and now. So it is a real fortress in Christchurch. But yeah, Blues got off to a great start, and there had been a lot. I think there was a lot of hype, particularly in New Zealand press during the week, about the game, and I touched on it last week. I think Crusaders will and have welcomed the challenge. They've probably been the dominant force, and well, obviously in New Zealand rugby and Super Rugby over the last number of seasons. So I think they definitely welcomed Auckland coming to town. And it really had to pull it out of the bag in the last 15 minutes. I know we'll probably talk in a little bit more detail about it, but I thought Blues brought the type of game that was expected, a real territorial game. And to be honest, there was quite a Northern Hemisphere feel to the game in terms of the volume of kicking from both teams in that opening half. I thought it was quite a dewy evening in Christchurch, which makes running rugby difficult, but in the opening few rounds, I think Blues have demonstrated a very pragmatic approach to the game, and through kind of Leo McDonald, who I'd rate very highly as a coach, he's kind of put a very simple structure in place for Blues to follow and leverage the kicking games of both, obviously, Otero Black at 10 and Bowden Barrett at 15, who seems to be treating the competition just to work on his left foot. I think he's probably watching a bit of Mason Greenwood at Man United and thought he'd be having a bit of that. So his kicking game off both feet now is really, really impressive to watch. And it hurt the Crusaders a number of times at the weekend.
It certainly did. Their last defeat in Christchurch was against the British and Irish Lions 3 years ago. So like, it doesn't even really count. Like, as in, they haven't been beaten obviously in domestic competition or Super Rugby in over 3 years, as you say, in that building. And look, as you said, like it did kind of resemble at times a Northern Hemisphere style of game. It felt as though in the first three quarters, the Blues kind of struck when they had to, or at least when it was kind of pressing for them to do so. Obviously, they had a disallowed try as well, but they ultimately take a lead into that three-quarter mark, like the hour mark. And from there, it kind of felt as though we saw the difference between a team that believed that maybe they might or could win and a team that just almost automatically know how to do it. And you have that really, like, I think it's a hinge moment, essentially, where Otiri Black's conversion of Rick Irwani's try is charged down by Braden Ennor. And then you have that little piece of magic from Richie Mwonga, who really became the catalyst in the Crusaders turning that game around in the final 20 minutes.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was really interesting, that the Blues' approach in the first half, because, as you said, they got off to a good start and scored their first try, and I think it was in the first 10 minutes off a really kind of powerful break off the back of the scrum from Hoskins to 2-2, who's been a kind of revelation at number 8 for the Blues. And it's very interesting, the profile of the two packs. In the kind of Auckland pack, you've got a lot of a really athletic back row in Akira Ioni and Satuto particularly, and then Patrick Tupiloto in the second row. And I think their pack definitely is a different type profile to the Crusaders pack, and has given them a little bit more bend, especially with their middles in the middle of the pitch. And it was interesting, Scott Robertson kind of said it after the game, that their kicking plan was quite ineffective because they weren't getting gain line with their forwards. And kind of really what that means is, and why the Blues are doing so well with their kicking game, is that often when there's space to attack with the ball means you can manipulate the backfield probably that little bit easier, because backfield defenders are having to come forward to protect that space in the front line, which opens up kick space in behind. But when you're not denting the gain line with your kind of your forward runners or your kind of your centers, then it's very easy for the backfield defenders to remain in backfield because they're not having to come forward to defend frontline space, and it makes a kicking game very difficult. So Crusaders were really, really finding it difficult to kind of win the kick battle against the Blues, and I think a large part of that was to do with particularly the Blues pack and their outside backs as well. I guess if you look at Caleb Clark, who's kind of burst onto the scene as a young kind of 21, 22-year-old, and Rick Ioni, they just seem to have a lot more game breakers in their team than potentially the Crusaders do. So it could be a little bit of a changing of a guard there. But as you said, it really was... The Crusaders were kind of just hanging in there with kind of ticking over 3-6 points without really kind of stamping any authority on the game. And as you said, they literally sparked into life when the Blues scored that try. That the crowd noise was deafening off the first the charge down from Ennor and then the quick restart from Mwonga. And really, I think Richie Mwonga had showed what a kind of world-class 10 he's become. He kind of almost dragged the Crusaders back into the game single-handedly, obviously with that quick restart. And then that beautiful kind of double bump pass to Bridge down that left side was the catalyst to that line break. Drummond, who had come on at 9, ran that really good support line on the inside that we see all the top class 9s doing now to kind of score the try and get the Crusaders back in the game. And Mwanga was the catalyst to that comeback in the last quarter.
He certainly was. Like as you mentioned, it was almost off the back of Iwani's try where this charge down happens by Ennor. The crowd like just go berserk. And then I think for Mwanga to have like the presence of mind to do what he did, I don't know, it was just this kind of, it felt like an amazing read of the room.
Yeah.
And like an understanding of the psychology again, but not even just an understanding of it, like he actually kind of controlled it in a way. He just ramped it up that little bit more with a piece of skill and like a piece of audacity that, like, I don't know that I've really seen it since playing EA Sports Rugby 08 12 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, like, I didn't even think people thought of doing this in a professional game anymore.
Yeah, and just have the presence of mind. He obviously was the one to chase the quick kickoff and slid on his knees and was patient enough to wait for the ball to cross the 10-metre and then regathered the ball. That's just real cool temperament, as you said, in a kind of frenetic atmosphere. And I think probably, I think it was a good thing for especially the Canterbury crowd to have this challenge of a Blues team coming at them, and potentially a little bit of comfort over the last couple of years. We've touched on how long it's been since they've been defeated there, and I think that really kind of just burst them into life, and the players kind of reacted accordingly. And it was a really impressive 20 minutes. As you said, the self-belief in that team was kind of to the fore, and I think it'll be a really good learning experience for the kind of younger, more inexperienced Blues side, that that they'll take a lot from it as well.
Yeah, it did feel like that kind of a game, all right. Those sorts of defeats can be the makings of teams further down the road. You mentioned that the Blues arguably have a couple more game breakers now than the Crusaders do in their arsenal. How then do the Blues manage to replicate the Crusaders' level, if not quite the dynastic dominance that they've shown over the last, you know, decade and more, just in terms of actually being able to close out a game like that, or being able to kind of strike while the iron is hot the way the Crusaders did through Muonga and others? Like, there's a kind of I guess there's a kind of a collective IQ required, but how do you actually instill that in a team? Is it purely through reps on a weekly basis and having to go through what they did at the weekend before you start to kind of figure out how to implement a little bit more game management to go with those game breakers in your makeup?
Yeah, I think there's a little bit of going through the pain. I think it happens to most top teams before they actually kind of reach the pinnacle, is you have to build up these sometimes hurtful lessons. But I just think they've got to stick to what they're doing for a full 80 minutes. It was a game of test match intensity, and moments come down, or games like that come down to very small moments. And we talked about Muonga just kind of wrestling back control of the game with just a moment of magic. And especially once you've scored a try, that's really a time you got to be really alert and kind of be ready to go off the restart. And the Blues will be disappointed with that. And then those little two or three moments of momentum that shift the game, it can be often very hard to pull it back. And I know in the first half, Blues were probably winning those little momentum battles, and that was turning kind of pressure into points. So yeah, it's about putting in a full 80 minutes performance, and the Crusaders definitely weren't at their best, but they were able to just do enough, and as we kind of talked about, win back those moments. And then we talked about Will Jordan last week, what a rich vein of form he's been in, and for the Crusaders to have the luxury to bring him off the bench. And I know me and Murray spoke about his kind of game reading ability as a winger, to be able to come off his wing and read the play, and that's exactly what he does for that critical try in 75 minutes. He's on the right wing, but he works infield from right to left, and it's a real typical setup where Muonga gets the ball. He's got Goodhue coming short, and it looks like Jordan is going to just roam out the back of Goodhue for that pullback pass, but he just sees a mismatch and breaks between Muonga and Goodhue and breaks through the middle of them to use a great bit of footwork to score, and that's a moment of individual brilliance as well, and for the Crusaders to be able to bring off that kind of talent off the bench ultimately probably was the difference.
You alluded to it earlier, Muonga's double pump pass out to Mitchell Drummond, who feeds George Bridge inside then for what's a pivotal score at the time, just before Will Jordan goes over to finish the game off.
Yeah.
Muonga's pass, like, I saw so many people tweeting it out and people waxing lyrical about it, understandably. Like, it's so picturesque and aesthetically pleasing, but also most pertinently incredibly effective. What about George Bridge's pass inside, though? I felt that was it felt as though that was slightly underrated in the circumstances, when you consider how different a type of pass it was. So, like, Muonga is spiraling the ball off his good hand, and he just fires it out like a rocket But Drummond, or sorry, Bridge kind of does that pass that you were taught how to do at kind of under 12s, under 13s, even though you're slightly uncomfortable doing it because you want to spiral a pass. He just flicks it. But like, he gets incredible kind of velocity behind it for what's actually quite a long pass inside.
Yeah, off his weaker side as well, as you've mentioned. And there, I think that's a really big part of New Zealand rugby, is those core skills, especially with their All Blacks and kind of top performing Super Rugby players, is at such a high level that's just an expectation that those passes are executed, because it's something they spend a huge amount of time in training on individual core skills, and it's just a big focus of New Zealand rugby, and why they're so good at it is they spend a huge amount of time repping those things, whether it's a double pump, and probably touch on a little bit is Mark Talea, the Blues right winger. I thought Crusaders targeted him very, very well with their kicking game. Kick contestable on top of him, and Bridge in the air won a couple of those aerial battles against him as well. And Talea is a kind of inexperienced wing learning his trade that's very good with ball in hand, but probably has a couple of deficiencies defensively and early. And for Mwanga, Talea is a guy that bites in from out to in, and Mwanga just has a composure to what we mean by a double pump is he looks to pass, he sees Talea biting in, and rather than still throwing the pass, or what you'll often see when a defender pressures from the outside in, is that the ball player will step back in under the pressure rather than staying composed. Okay, he's seeing that the pass is not the first time, but having the composure then to kind of hold his feet and then play the pass a second time, which is a really, really tough skill to do. But it was just a little bit of inexperience from Talea on that right wing, probably just showed his cards a touch too early, and Mwanga was able to pick him off to Bridge. And I think the other thing about Bridge is he's kind of a really rounded player as well. I think him and Jordan will probably be the Crusaders and All Blacks wingers for some time to come. I think they just have the kind of full array of skills required to play at the top level, and that's probably an area where a couple of the Blues backs have a little way to go, but will come with experience.
Yeah, that is a frightening prospect, as they tend to be really when we're talking about future All Blacks and that particular dynasty. Let's talk a little bit then about the Hurricanes and Highlanders. There was controversy which kind of overshadowed the opening minutes of this one, but again, like just a moment of sheer quality proved absolutely crucial to it. That incredible Jordy Barrett pass off his left out to the right hand side. It was overshadowed really this fixture as a whole by what was going on in Christchurch, and I think for the Hurricanes and the Highlanders it's really about podium positions now at this point, when you consider there aren't any playoffs, etc., in this version of Super Rugby. But it was a decent game. It's also a game that, like, neither team would have been obviously neither team would have been keen to lose it, but you kind of have an opportunity to become the best of the rest when you start racking up wins in these kinds of games. What was your impression of it in an overall sense before we get into the kind of nitty gritty of it?
Yeah, difficult conditions in Wellington, which is often the case. It's right down by the water there, and there's always a swirling wind, which makes kind of open running expansive rugby quite difficult. I think the Canes would probably give to have a kind of environment like the Highlanders have in Dunedin with the indoor stadium. So conditions were tricky. Canes have definitely been struggling with their form this year, and the Highlanders are kind of on a little bit of a rebuild with not a huge amount of All Blacks in their squad at the moment. They're kind of trying to rebuild with a young, talented team, but it's going to take time for them to put in kind of consistent performances. But I think definitely you can see from the Highlanders' perspective that their pack is starting to become a really cohesive unit, and they attacked the Hurricanes line-out maul, I thought, pretty impressively, and ultimately they were able to score a try off the back of it through Aaron Smith. But it was one of those funny games. There's no scores in the first 25 minutes, which is almost unheard of for New Zealand rugby to be zip-zip after 25. Obviously, a couple of disallowed tries, both for obstructions. They were pulled back from the TMO. One from a really, really good counter-attack from Mitchell Hunt, who I have to say is growing into that 10 position at the Highlanders. He was at the Crusaders for the last couple of years as an understudy to Mwanga, and has obviously seen the writing on the wall that he's probably not going to usurp Mwanga in that 10 position. So he's moved franchises to the Highlanders, and he's got really, really nice footwork. He's quite a diminutive in stature, but really, really nice footwork, balanced runner, good kicking game, and he was the one that made that line break off the counter attack, and but for a little bump from Ash Dixon on, I think it was on Hurricanes number 7, Cariffy, that got pulled back. It would have been Highlanders going out to a lead, which I think they needed, especially being a young team. I think in the last 22 games, there's only been one score between the two sides. So they're always quite tight affairs, but. And then only a couple of minutes later, Loamapi try was disallowed for another obstruction. I think it was another young Fletcher Smith for the Hurricanes, ran behind one of his own players to be pulled back for obstruction. So it was a bit of a cat and mouse game in that opening 25 minutes before it sparked to life. I guess one of the lovely matchups was TJ Perenara and Aaron Smith, the starting and second choice nine for New Zealand pretty much for the last decade. And they've got very different styles of play. Perenara is a real competitor, very kind of abrasive type of nine, whereas Aaron Smith's probably a little bit more tactically astute and a little bit more of a manipulator. But Perenara got one up with him on that first try. He saw Aaron Smith coming into that first defender around the ruck and dummies and goes through, and Aaron Smith will be hating that. I think there was a little bit of lip after from TJ. He wasn't shy of a couple of words on the pitch, and that was the opening try to kind of break the deadlock for what was it was an eventful, but obviously no scores in the first half of that half of rugby. So good to see TJ to get one over on his fellow competitor.
Yeah, it certainly was. Both of them captains on the day as well. So serious bragging rights up for grabs. And as you say, like scoreboard wise, somewhat uneventful early doors. It kind of eventually sparks into life. Like, look, the Hurricanes get the job done in the end. Did you have them as being kind of the better team in an overall sense watching that game? Or was it one of those games that just kind of goes one way or the other without a team necessarily deserving it more so than the other, if you know what I mean?
Probably the game breakers. We talked about Jordy Barrett last week, how huge an influence he had for the Canes to go up to Hamilton and win there. And I thought he was a catalyst again. You already mentioned it, Gav. Like, that's one for the YouTube highlights. It's a lovely little shape that maybe we can chat about. The Hurricanes run there. I've seen it a few times. So essentially, the ball goes to 10 and he's got a traditional forward shape outside him. So three forward players outside the 10 and he hits the middle forward. And Barrett is sat just in behind the forward pod in that kind of traditional second playmaker position. And Gav, ultimately what normally happens is the 10 will play the middle forward and the middle forward will either carry tip to the outside forward runner or play a little hinge ball to the second playmaker to Barrett to go wide. But it's a lovely little kind of variation where the middle forward takes it to the line. The outside forward takes a little bit of an overs line to try and drag the defender with him. And it creates a little vacuum of space for Jordy Barrett to kind of sneak through. And he comes right through the middle of those two forwards to make the line break. And it's a lovely shape. Very, very hard to do. I think it's Scott Scrafton, the lock for the Hurricanes, that makes the pass. Stays really, really square, which is crucial. And Barrett just sides through the middle. And it's really creative. Not a lot of team. A few teams have tried to run it. Not overly successful. The Canes have done it for the last couple of seasons in Super really, really well. But then he's got a ridiculous 25-metre pass. You've already spoken about Bridges' pass left to right. Well, this is on another level, really. Windy in Wellington. He probably knows where Van Wyk is going to be as a right winger, and can see him out of his peripheral vision. But it's still a ridiculously hard pass to throw. And it just shows the class that he is to be able to find the winger. And Van Wyk scores his second try in as many games, and that really took the game away from the Highlanders. Just kind of coming up to halftime, it would have been a little bit demoralising because Highlanders had probably had their fair share of possession that first half, but to fall, I think that made a 14 or 12-3 behind just before halftime was difficult. But without doubt, the highlight of the game and as you said, one for the YouTube highlights.
Yeah, literally just as you're talking through it there, I got a gif up from Key and Tracy, actually, of the Irish Independent. I've just been like watching it on a loop as you've been explaining what's going on around it. But it just gets better and better with every viewing. I'm sure most people listening to this podcast, given it's about Super Rugby, will have seen at least highlights of the games over the weekend. But it's one for your lunch break later on as well, I think. Just put it on a loop. I'd recommend it. Let's talk then a little bit about Australia before I let you go, Owen. Obviously, you are perfectly positioned to do so. And we had a drawn game, which was interesting. And I suppose the first question to ask you is I remember you were talking to Murray last week and you kind of mentioned how understandably it was difficult for the Australian teams kind of getting up to speed. Like if you were comparing watching the Australian Super Rugby games to some of the New Zealand games we've seen over the last few weeks, it's not even a fair comparison really, because the Australians are just getting back into the swing of things. They have the implementation of laws that are a little bit stricter than they would have been before they left months ago, and also the 50-22 rule, which came into play as well over the weekend. So did you feel as though there was a kind of an improvement, generally speaking, in what you saw from the Australian franchises involved, or will it take another few weeks even before they're kind of, up to speed properly?
Yeah, I thought probably the Friday night game, the Rebels and the Reds, was played up in Manly. It was a home game for the Rebels, but obviously with no sport being able to happen in Victoria, they've had to move up to New South Wales. And from an intensity perspective, huge improvement from I think the Rebels from their round one game against the Brumbies. There was some enormous collisions in that game. There's probably another one for you to look for some gifts there, Gav, when you have time. Pane Faramasuli, who has coached down at the Rebels since his under 20s day, is an enormous man. His nickname at the Rebels is John Coffey from the Green Mile, for those of you who've watched that movie. he when he came into the program, he's probably about 160 kilos, and he's about 145 now. And Bryce Haggerty was ill-advisedly decided to run at him from a counter-attack position, and he almost broke poor Bryce in two with a collision. And he's got a really exciting future ahead of him. He's obviously an enormous man, but with really good foot speed. And there's another occasion where the Reds kicked long to him off I think it was a goal line dropout, and he's given it the wind up from about 40 meters to carry, and it was just a really, really good moment. So from a physicality perspective, I thought the collisions were really good. It was wet conditions in Manly, which is unfortunate. And both teams, there was plenty of kicking. I think Rebels kicked 39 times and the Reds 34. But there was just a lack of accuracy at times. There was a high number of turnovers. Both teams struggled with their lineouts. I think Rebels lost four of their 12 and Reds lost 6 of their 17. And when the set piece is misfiring, it's hard to get flow in the game, and it was a little bit stop start at times. The endeavour was definitely there from both teams. There's some really promising, as I've spoken about, from a Rebels perspective and from a Reds perspective, of young guys coming through, but just lacked that kind of finishing touch at times. But we had our first super time. Obviously, the scores were locked after 10 minutes, or sorry, after 80 minutes. One of the new laws is that they'll play an additional 10 minutes of extra time effectively, but it was probably anything but super, to be honest, Gav. I think there was 19 there was confusion from the get-go. The referee, once it went into once the 80 minutes had finished, the referee was trying to get the super time to start straight away. He'd said no break, we're straight into it. And then he was informed, no, there's a 2 minute break after the 80 minutes had finished. So then we had a break, and then he didn't know which team kicked off for super time. So that had to be decided. And then we didn't know if it was two halves of five or it was a 10 minute block. So it was slightly confusing for all parties, referee, players, people watching on TV. But it probably just has some creases to iron out. Obviously, There was no winner after super time, and a bit like soccer, Gav, after extra time you go to penalties, but there was no penalties ensuing. So I think you're going to have a little think about maybe tweaking a couple of the laws. Obviously, no team wanted to lose the game, so there was 19 kicks in that 10-minute block and not much else happened. Bryce Hegarty had a chance to win it from 50 metres and that just went agonisingly wide. It's golden point, so whoever scores first wins. But people are talking about tries only win the game and to stop the clock during scrums, because as I said, it was anything but super that final 10 minutes. But fair play to Rugby Australia. They're trying to find different ways to engage kind of stakeholders, make it a little bit more exciting, and there's definitely an eagerness and a willingness to do it. But I just think Australian rugby on a whole is probably on a different cycle to New Zealand rugby, and it's definitely, when you compare that game and the Force Waratahs game to the game we've already spoken about in Christchurch, it's they're at different ends of the scale at the moment. But it's a building period for these guys in Super Rugby, and there's glimpses that there's some really good talent coming through.
Yeah, certainly. It did feel a bit anticlimactic to go through an extra time period and then wind up with a draw.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
Like, it kind of does beg a few questions. And you think the Australians as well may look at that and use it as an opportunity perhaps to do something that other people aren't doing, and just to get eyeballs on the game over there a little bit more as well. Just wanted to ask you about the Rebels. Obviously, you're so familiar with them, and it kind of feels as though it's been a weird season for them. Obviously, a weird season for everybody, in that it's kind of taken place months apart, with that massive divide in between. But like, when you look at how they had been getting on, they were kind of stop start. It seemed as though they'd win one week, lose the next week. They had a couple of very good results off the top of my head. They went to the Highlanders and won there. But most of their games were kind of high scoring as well. We saw them last week against the Brumbies. You and Murray rather chatted about that last week, and like, they weren't a million miles off. And this one, like, look, it's a draw. I don't know how you'd really compute it, but where do you think they are in relation to their Australian rivals to begin with? Like, do you think they're kind of on the right track, generally speaking, and how they're trying to go about things?
I think so. I think continuity of selection has just always been an issue at Melbourne. And if you look at this year, they got Ryan Lawrence and Matt Tamua playing 9 and 10, and they would never have played together before this season. And they're such crucial positions. Like, if you... I hate comparing to New Zealand rugby again, but if you look at the Crusaders, you got Bryn Hall and Mwanga, who would probably have well over 60, 70 games together. So those combinations always really take time to evolve. They've definitely looked to evolve their game style from last year, that definitely got found out towards the latter half of Super Rugby. And there was evolution on display, as you said earlier, in Super Rugby when they had those big wins against the Highlanders, the Lions in Melbourne. So it's about continuity of selection. I think it's really important for them, continuing with the halfbacks that they've got at the club now. And then I think the team that finished was quite inexperienced. I've mentioned Pane. I think that was only his second start at tight head prop. There's a really promising lock there, Trevor Hosea, who's from that core group of under-20s, Australia under-20s that got to the final of the World Cup last year, and Victorians as well, which I think is the other really important aspect for Melbourne, is bringing through local players, which has taken time to build up, I guess, those next generation of Victorians that have the ability to play Super Rugby. And that's starting to happen, and that's a credit to the coaches down there. And now, obviously, it's a cutthroat industry, isn't it? Professional sport. You want to develop those local guys, those younger guys, but also they've got quite a few Wallabies in their squad, and results will be expected. So it's trying to get that balance, and there's been glimmers of it. I think they'll be really disappointed not to win that game, to have a, whatever it was, a 10 point lead with 10 minutes to go. They should have closed it out, and they'll be disappointed in their kind of, I guess, their kicking strategy in that last quarter, I think, to kick the ball away with a minute to go when all they really need to do is run down the clock to get the win will have disappointed them, and something they'll work on. They've got a bye this week, but next week I think they play the Waratahs up in Sydney. So That'll be another good test from against an inexperienced New South Wales side as well. So,
yeah, they were put to the pin of their collar, the Waratahs, over the weekend, early doors against the Western Force. Ultimately, the Force kind of got a bit of a rude awakening. Waratahs scoring 23 unanswered points in 22 minutes to turn that one around. But I suppose maybe apart from the fact that Force took a 14-0 lead in that game, it was kind of how we would have anticipated this one going, I think. What did you make of the Waratahs, considering the Rebels are up next for them?
Yeah, to be honest, the Force have a really good recent record against the Waratahs, and their last game of Super Rugby back in 2017 was against the Waratahs, and I think they put over 40 points on them. So the New South Wales Waratahs held no fear to the Western Force, and there would have been a lot of emotion going into the game. Obviously, having been removed from Super Rugby to kind of 3 years out in the wilderness, and to come back into it would have been an extremely emotive occasion for them. And it was kind of reflected in the scoreboard. I think the difficulty for them, you mentioned the 23 unanswered points, is the fact they didn't have a game the week previously, whereas the New South Wales Waratahs played the Reds up in Queensland, so they had a game under their belt. I think that really kind of started to tell in the second half. And I thought the other really important point was the Waratahs bench. They had Carmichael Hunt, Jack Dempsey, Staniford Faulkner, all Wallabies to come off the bench, and I thought that really told in that second half. Particularly Carmichael Hunt, I thought he had a really big impact on the game. His kicking game was excellent, and probably exposed the Force's kind of more inexperienced backfield a little bit. And actually, honestly, there was a couple of 50-22 calls in the game, Gav. I know me and Murray spoke about it last week, and one of them ultimately led to the try, and it was quite a controversial moment that the 50-22 was awarded. Waratahs made a nice line break down the left side, and Lockie Swinton actually carried the ball past the 50-metre line into the Western Force half, but he placed the ball back on the literally on the 50-metre line. And from that ruck, they went wide to Carmichael Hunt, who hit a 50-22. He was clearly inside the 50, and it landed in the Force 22, which meant that Waratahs got the resulting line out. But on the replay, it clearly showed Swinton had carried outside the 50 and placed the ball back in, which ultimately, it's like passing the ball from outside your 22 back into it and kicking out in the full, that it was the wrong call. The TMO had a look about it, and that's a frustrating thing. I think that'll really hurt the Force coaching staff that it wasn't overturned. And the Waratahs scored from the resulting line-out. They kind of played around the back, and a couple of pick and goes later, and I think Scott Staniford, who'd come off the bench, scored a try, and it was a pivotal moment in the game. And the old 50-22 law was probably the talking point in both dressing rooms after the game.
Yeah, as you say, the Force would have been fairly emotional coming into that one, and I'm sure to have a game hinge upon a rule that wasn't there the last time they were playing Super Rugby would have been a source of frustration for them as well.
Yeah, but they're playing a lovely style. They're playing a lovely style of rugby as well. They've probably got a little bit of a wide attack. They've got three tens in their back line. John O'Lance, who's been over in Europe the last couple of seasons at the Worcester Warriors. He was due to go to Edinburgh, but when COVID kicked in, that contract, I think, was rescinded, and he's moved back to Australia. And he's a really experienced 10. And then they've got a young 10 playing a 12 and Nick Deust. And then Jack McGregor, who spent time at Melbourne. He's a really promising 10 as well. And he's kind of made 15 his position since moving over to Perth. And those three playmakers in their back line facilitate a kind of wide attack. And it was really, really good to see. They're a well-coached side, and they're going to be a tough side to beat in Super Rugby, I think, especially if teams have to go over to Perth. It's almost like going to a different country. It's a five-hour flight from east to west. So it's a difficult trip. Always found that with the Rebels. So it's great to see them back in from an Australian context in Super Rugby. And I think they'll only strengthen the competition.
Absolutely. Yeah, as you say, it seems as though they're actually enjoying themselves as well, watching them play. Like, it is aesthetically pleasing. Owen, pleasure as always. Thanks a million for all of that. We'll chat to you again next Monday, please God.
Great to chat, Gav. Enjoy the sport coming up during the week. It's great to see all different sports happening over there at the moment, isn't it? I was even watching the cricket at the weekend, the England-West Indies game, which Test match cricket is slow to watch at the best of times, but when there's no one in the crowd dressed up in stupid Mario and Luigi outfits or Big Bird outfits, there's literally no distractions. So
I think it must be a producer's nightmare, you know, that you don't have any B-roll to cut to. It's like, where do I go with the cameras? Like, but yeah, I mean, yeah, you're right. At least there is a bit of sport happening. I just saw, literally as we were talking there, Manchester City's appeal to the Court of Arbitration for Sport has been successful. So they will be playing in the Champions League next season, which is a blow if you're a Man United fan.
Well, I am a Man United fan, but I've kind of called it for some time that I fancied us to catch Leicester, and it appears my predictions might be coming true after their loss last night. So I think with United's running, they've got the easier of the running of Chelsea and Leicester. So obviously you have to go to Leicester last day of the season, but it would be great to see them finish third or fourth and ultimately make Champions League the right way. I think finishing fifth and getting in probably would have been a little bit hollow. But it makes that race for 3 and 4 that bit more exciting now, doesn't it? Probably come down to the last game.
It does heat it up a little bit, yeah, I have to say. And as you say, there would have been absolutely no honour in finishing fifth and playing Champions League next season. What they have to do, obviously, is beat Southampton. It seems like that's the kind of game they would have lost or just bottled, basically, over the last 3 or 4 years when they've had any sort of momentum. So
yeah,
a lot will hinge on tonight. Anyway, I've managed to derail this podcast altogether.
Not at all. All good, thanks.
42 members who enjoy Paul Dollery's Football Family podcast have probably been starved of content. But no. Owen, pleasure as always. Thanks a million.
Great to chat. Take care, Gaff. Cheers.
Mind yourself. Thanks, everybody at home as well. We are on hiatus from the regular rugby pod on Thursdays, just for a few weeks. While Murray is away, we usually kind of take a break around this time of year anyway, but we will catch up with Owen again next week. So until then, mind yourselves and take it easy.
I don't think we've met before, but I'm the referee on this field.
If you're working as an accountant and you lose your job, nobody really notices.
Leinster could offer me $5 million a year, I wouldn't go.
It is Tommy Moe!
Rugby Weekly.
Little reverse pass.
Drive
You're not alive, boys, so you start kicking when the room is spinning and the words are...